Kia ora and welcome back to the show. Right, well, it's been, I always say this, but I guess it's always in the active world in politics. It's kind of, it doesn't really go through a quiet stage. But anyway, it's been busy in politics recently, and to discuss it all, I have a leader of the Opportunities Party and a former Christchurch City Councillor, Mr. Raph Manji, on the line. Good morning, Raph.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Tell me, are you finding that at the moment, politics just very busy?
Yeah, it never stops, you know, and I actually sort of penciled in a three-day break last week because I thought it would be quiet after Easter, Parliament's in recess, and then I had 2 days of dealing with staff, and then the government, you know, launched the affordable water reforms, and I was doing interviews from the Hooker Valley track down in the
National Park.
And I had to sort of, I was standing there in the rain trying to find a place for good cell phone reception. So yes, it's quite hard to get away from. There's always something going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's just kick straight into it then. Something that's caused a bit of chatter recently is a lot of people have been questioning how the National Party vets or picks its candidates, just given recent controversy with one of their candidate selections. I mean, this is probably not as black and white as I'm asking it, but do you think the National Party picks good candidates?
Yeah, that's a bit of a tough question. Look, it's really difficult. I mean, look, I was having this conversation with my political science professor from University of Canterbury yesterday, and we meet up regularly to discuss political matters. And yeah, his view that MMP had essentially diluted the quality of candidates, and because we have the list system, is people basically just appear from nowhere. I mean, that's how the system works.
Yeah, right.
Now, in the old days, you know, people were more rooted in their communities. They came up through party networks. People sort of knew who they were, and you know, over time, you know, maybe they got to sort of the top table in terms of being a candidate. Whereas under MMP, candidates come in from anywhere. And look, I mean, we have the same issue ourselves. So people just sort of decide, oh, I'd like to stand, maybe, you know, 6 months out from an election, and then they just appear as a candidate. So it's ultimately a result of MMP. And the lack of the focus on the electorate MP and the focus on just sort of getting candidates from all over the place. So that makes the vetting thing more difficult because you haven't had these people rooted in the community for a long time. And I think what we're seeing, you know, I think National just announced their Wellington Central candidate. You know, the person's working overseas. I mean, they're literally just moving back.
Wow.
For the election. Now, the guy's extremely well qualified and so on and so forth, but nobody knows him in Wellington Central.
Yeah, right.
You know, so this is the list electorate thing, and I think it is having an impact on candidate selection, because each election, essentially, you're casting around for candidates to fill the list positions. And so, yeah, you're always going to run into difficulties around vetting, and that's always going to be a bit of a challenge. So yeah, it's essentially the MMP system that's driving this problem.
Wow, that's so interesting. I didn't kind of view it that way. For National though, do you still think they have this whole pale, stale male issue? Do you think that kind of naturally the political philosophy of the National Party still is really going to attract that very traditional conservative European base?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I have noticed that they've put forward a lot more Indian candidates, which is good. I mean, I haven't looked at their breakdown of everything. But yeah, I mean, essentially, if you think about it, National is a party that represents the, you know, the old-fashioned liberals and the farmers. I mean, that's how they were fought.
Yeah.
Back in the 1930s, and you know, they've become a sort of a broad church party, but you know, there's still obviously strong conservative elements within the party, and there's, you know, a few liberals there, and then sort of a mixture of sort of business people. So, yeah, I think the problem for National at the moment that a lot of people are finding is they're not quite clear what they're about.
Yeah, right.
And I think, look, we're going into, you know, as we've discussed before, a new phase, a new big geopolitical cycle. All around the world, things are changing, and clarity over politics is not, you know, is not easily discernible for a lot of people.
And
that's what I'm talking to people on the doorstep. They're kind of, yeah, they think the government's done a poor job, but they really don't see, they don't really understand what National is offering. And so people are a little bit kind of like, oh, okay, we don't really know what's going on here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it?
The lack of vision. I mean, obviously, vision's always something people are a little bit sceptical about. But there's not really a clear sense of what this election is even going to be about. And so, I mean, for me, it's very simple. It's about how do we build a sustainable society where everyone has the opportunity to thrive. But a lot of these political parties are stuck with a lot of old legacy baggage, and they haven't quite worked out what they're doing. You know. So this is life. It's like the 80s. I think this election is going to be like the sort of 87, 1990 type election where things could split all over the place.
Oh, sounds traumatic. I'm here for that.
Well, I think so. You probably, you know, the Labour National is struggling to get above 35%. And, you know, the left and right, as it were, sort of baked in. And we're seeing a rise in the vote towards the others, so essentially the smaller parties, as people search around for other options. But the 5% threshold makes it very difficult to get that change. And that's the problem with MMP, is it was designed to get fresh ideas coming in and get a turnover and new parties, but the threshold has made it very difficult for that to happen.
Are you surprised there hasn't been more of a conversation, this threshold? Because I feel like it's almost the elephant in the room, where everyone knows that a 5% threshold is slightly too high. Are you surprised there's not more conversation about it?
But no, because the big parties love it.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
right. As one Labour MP said to me, "Oh, we love it, the threshold, because we get the wasted vote."
Yeah, right.
So it's pure self interest. But yeah, so people really struggle with it. So I mean, I know for us, a lot of people go, "Oh, look, we'd vote for you if we thought you'd get in." It's like, okay. So vote for us and we will get in, but it's a chicken and an egg thing. So I think that's why Ireland is so important, because it's sort of a beachhead. It gives people some confidence. Okay, if you can win Ireland, then at least you'll be in Parliament. But I think the threshold needs to come down. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck in this kind of stale mess that we're in at the moment.
Yeah, real shame. Anyway, moving on. Labour, announcing yesterday that I'd like to decrease class size, which kind of took me by surprise, just given the current kind of government versus teacher relationship right now. Do you think this is a bit of a bold move by them?
Well, not if you talk to the teachers, no. They just thought it was an absolute damp squib. So, you know, the Prime Minister announces this during the school holidays, so does the kind of the photo op at a school, which is closed, there's nobody there. And they had to get three poor kids to come in on their school holidays and get dressed up in the school uniform.
Oh, dear.
And then take photos, essentially, at a school where nobody is. It was hilarious. Anyway, so the teachers don't think it's... I mean, they're not happy with it, because they're saying, actually, class sizes need to be reduced by 4 or 5, not by 1.
Yeah, yeah.
And
right.
Actually, it doesn't really help them, because, you know, a lot of them are already maxed out in terms of space in their schools. And actually, in a school of sort of 300, potentially that means you need another classroom for the other kids. It's not like you can suddenly disappear these children. So let's say that the one child in each class that's been taken out, they've got to go somewhere else. So that means you need more teachers. And in fact, the problem that the teachers are saying is actually they need help in the classroom. So, you know, I was talking to a teacher the other day on the doorstep, and they said, the problem is I'm just spending too much time doing stuff in the classroom to support kids who need help, and I'm not teaching the subject. So we need more teacher aides in there, as well as class sizes. Now, if you reduce a class size from 29 to 28. That's a marginal help. You know, when the teacher might have 5 or 8 kids who need extra help. So it's really it's the teacher aid and the support in the classroom that is probably more helpful.
Given that teachers, well, primary school teachers are going to vote soon on a new pay offer, was this a poor attempt at just trying to sweeten that deal, do you think?
Yeah, probably. I mean, there's a lot of pay issues at the moment. In fact, the Auditor General has just decided the government needs to pay up for these outstanding holiday pay for health workers and teachers, which is going to be about $2 billion, which needs to be paid out. So, yeah, there's a lot of pay stress everywhere. And this problem is not going to go away. We've got structural problems in all our public services, you know, education, health, the police, and it's the same problem. It's poor pay, poor conditions, lack of supply, and, you know, essentially government policy that has driven this around immigration and their COVID response, where they allowed house prices to go up, you know, 40%. So it's a struggle, there's no doubt, and I think teachers are feeling the pinch, whichever way you look at it.
Yesterday, David Seymour came out and said school attendance is so low, it doesn't matter anyway. And kind of redirected the conversation to about what's being taught in the classrooms. Now, whether it's been taught well or not, do you think like our curriculum focuses on the right things, or do you think that would put students off going to school?
Well, I mean, the big problem is kids going to school. That, you know, once you're in school, that's a good start. But again, we've discussed this before. It's those, in a way, social determinants of education, like health. Mm. It's what's happening at home. I mean, the attendance levels are a huge worry. You know, there's just not enough kids attending school. It's a huge social problem that we've got, and that is related to issues in the home, poor housing, poverty issues, poor health, you know, young people having to do other things, whether it's working or the other kids to school. So there's just this huge strain at the moment. And so, yes, we can argue about the curriculum and do we focus more on, you know, the 3 R's, and do we focus more on traditional approaches to education? There's a lot of debate about that. Do we focus more on the sort of Finland-type model where we're looking at, you know, creativity and innovation and critical thinking and collaboration and cooperation? You know, the sort of skills that actually we need for the future when you think about the technology that's coming through with AI, with ChatGPT, and the ability to have information at your fingertips. Mm. But actually, what are you going to do with that information? How do you analyze that information? Do you understand that information? And then we've got, you know, a lot of workplaces and businesses saying that the kids that are coming out of school don't have the appropriate basic skills in terms of literacy, numeracy. And so, yeah, it doesn't sound like good news, because it's not. But, you know, we need to get on top of this, and we need to have a sort of a clearer plan that we're going to get all our kids to school. They're going to be well fed. And if that means we've got to provide, you know, school breakfast, lunches, great, let's do that. And let's get the classroom to be a place where children can actually learn and learn stuff that is actually going to be helpful for them when they leave school.
Moving on, finally, one issue I want to talk about is the property developer Chris Meehan up in Auckland has spent quite a lot of his own money, actually, and has made a bit of noise basically about government red tape, about bureaucracy around developing homes and basically building. Do you think he has a point?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, what I don't understand with this whole proposal is that Kangaura is kind of not engaging with this guy. And, you know, if there's a reason why this big development doesn't work, they need to be upfront and say it. why and engage with him. So it's, you know, you've got developers like me here, and, you know, you've got Mike Greer here in Christchurch. I mean, these people are trying to build houses so that people can actually have somewhere to live. And there just still seems to be so many problems with the resource consenting process. The government said all this stuff is going to be speeded up, and it doesn't seem to be happening. And I think also the Kainga Ora also being a developer creates a conflict of interest. So we know that
they're
competing with developers, and I think we discussed this before, they're, you know, competing for land with other people. Their job is actually just to make sure housing is getting built.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be doing it themselves. You know, the Community Housing Association is doing great work. You know, we've made that proposal to set up that $3 billion community housing fund to fund them to build houses. And the private sector want to get on and build houses too. So if you get those two sectors going, you know, full pelt, Kainga Ora's job should be to support that, not actually be in there competing and developing themselves and trying to say, oh, we're doing a great job, we're delivering houses. And you don't need to do that. You know, the community sector can deal with the community housing issue. And social housing, public housing, and the private sector can deal with the rest of the market. So they should be doing everything. Like if someone calls up and says, I can't get this 5,000 home development through, they should be on the phone saying, how can we help? How
yeah,
can we make it
yeah,
work?
Right.
And if there are problems with it in terms of stormwater or soil issues, then resolve those issues, resolve them.
Is this a case of the truth being somewhere slightly in the middle? Where does there have to be an element of red tape, I guess? Because, you know, homes are where people live. They should be healthy, safe places to be. Is there a level of red tape required there to ensure we have quality housing?
Yeah, of course. And I think the problem is that with red tape is there's risk aversion. Because obviously we had the leaky homes issue.
Yeah.
And that costs a lot of money. And so councils tend to be, err on the side of conservatism. But the fact is, these developers are building houses day in, day out. They know how to build them.
Yeah.
And
yeah, right.
They just get so frustrated because their money is, you know, is on the counter the whole time. For officials, it's not. There's no risk to them. They've got no skin in the game. It's kind of 9 to 5, away you go. And there's no sense of urgency. And I think that's what frustrates developers. And I mean, I've been on both sides of this thing, and I've seen how it works. And following the earthquake as well, you know, a lot of developers were frustrated at the sort of the barriers to getting stuff done. And, you know, even I remember the Riverside development and some of the developments in Christchurch, and just really minor things. And it required people, you know, to kind of, you know, shake the tree and say, look, can you just get on with this? So I think, yeah, it is a problem. We need good rules and regulations, but the developers usually know what they are.
And, right.
You know, and you professionals, you know, architects and designers and planners who are developing these plans, and they're operating, you know, according to the rules. It's when they put the plans in, it just seems to take forever for people to get approval. And that has a knock-on effect, you know, because it means that houses are taking longer to build, it's more expensive, and that means the price goes up. So the quicker we can do this stuff, the cheaper it will be for everyone.
Gosh, it's the election is going to sneak up on us quickly. Housing taking forever, teaching not looking great, our health system not ideal. What does the government need to do to, as a plea to the public right now?
I think it's very, they don't have a lot of options, to be honest. You know, they've got a budget coming up. They've got maybe $4 billion plus to sort of spend. That's going to be sucked up pretty quickly. I mean, that will be education, health, police. That will go out the door very, very fast. And I think the problem the government's got is this election is going to be a referendum on their performance, which has not been good. And we're looking at a, you know, contraction in the economy. Inflation, particularly food prices, is still high. You know, it is going to come off. I mean, globally, food prices are coming down quite strongly. We're seeing inflation easing in the major economies. That will filter through here. But by the time you get to the election, I don't know. I think the government is going to struggle to sell anything positive about, you know, how they've done. And they're just relying on the fact that National don't have much to offer. So, I mean, this is why it's a kind of a neck-and-neck election and why it's been so close for a long time. And why probably, yeah, we will see a shift to the minor parties, then we'll have the threshold issue. So I'm not seeing anything that Labour has to offer that is anything new. And they've got a long list of things which have gone wrong in the last 3 years, the last 6 years. So, yeah, it's going to be an interesting election, and I think probably the public will either be fixed in their positions or be looking for something new, a new story. Labour's going to have to really, you know, think quite hard about what that new story is, because essentially they're throwing out most of what they've campaigned on in the last 3 years, and they've got a whole host of problems to deal with as well.
Yeah, that certainly seems like a great fodder for opposition parties, given the fact they've thrown away so many of their former policies. That certainly won't help them, will it?
No, because they don't have a story. They're essentially giving themselves an F mark for the last 3 years. And then they sort of need to start from scratch with, you know, Chris Hipkins, who I don't think is a particularly charismatic character, and I'm not sure he's going to be able to sell a new vision for the future, where, you know, like Jacinda did. I mean, she had that charisma and that sort of star quality who could tell a story. And we're in a very difficult situation. Governments, you know, tend to lose elections rather than oppositions winning them. And it's very hard to see a government winning an election with the economic conditions that we're going to be facing. You know, we're less than 6 months out from the election. Looks like we've got a recession coming. The Reserve Bank is just out of control. Minister of Finance kind of just hands off, nothing to do with me. And I don't think the public is going to quite see it like that.
Well, I think you've made a great argument for minor parties here, to
That's
be honest.
That's right. Opportunity party. But I think it's important that we have, you know, we're having a reset after, you know, 3 very challenging years, you know, with post-COVID. A government that has, frankly, gone off the rails. I mean, we don't often see a prime minister just leaving because they've given up.
No.
And then, you know, when John Key stepped down, it was a very smooth transition. You know, he didn't want to do a fourth term. Fair enough. It was a safe pair of hands transition. But with this, the prime minister basically, you know, waved the white flag and said, I'm out of here. And then in the last 3 months, it's been, let's throw out all the policies that we had previously. And, yeah, it's not a good look, really.
No, honestly, it's very bizarre. Anyway, Raf, thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's very much appreciated, and good luck. Just good luck,
well, good
I guess.
Luck, yeah, good luck getting through the week.
Yeah. Have a great day.
Okay, take it easy. See you.
And that was the wonderful Mr. Raf Manji.